Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes, copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes, and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was talking about the different types of winter storms that we experience here in Maine. We resume Suburban Safari on page 184, and this is episode 18. Why doesn't every living squirrel and crow either hibernate or hightail it south to avoid this mess? Why do they stick it out, wide awake, through the blistering cold? Well, I'm a potentially migratory mammal. Why don't I go to Florida? I suppose the practical answer is that going south would entail the expense of moving myself and then securing a southern territory, and when I returned in the spring, I might find my old territory had been invaded. Furthermore, I've figured out how to find food here in the winter, and I've adopted behaviors that reduce my risk of freezing solid. And that must be what a crow or a squirrel would reply to. He would tally his expenses in body fat rather than money, but the economic fundamentals are the same. So the answer must be that for a squirrel or a crow, living outdoors in the screaming wind and snow is easier than migrating or hibernating. It doesn't look easy, though. The 13 coldest days of the year on average, Dave Santoro queries from my TV screen on January 13th. When do they start? His eyebrows leap. A blue word shivers large and larger until it fills the screen. Tomorrow! On recent nights, the mercury has fallen to 10, even 5 degrees. Dave says the next few nights will go well below zero. When I strap on snowshoes the following morning, it's 12 degrees. I take a turn around the yard to see who's survived. Some mammals have the option of hibernating through the 13 coldest days of the year, but most species have evolved to face them head-on. This morning, mouse tracks trickle down the deck steps and along the shoveled path toward the driveway. They turn and enter a hole in the snowbank. Kneeling, I find a series of tunnel doorways. I've been scattering seed on the path for ground-feeding birds. Who knows how the little rodents detected the seed or how far they tunneled to reach it? I felt sorry for the mice when the Christmas storm dumped 18 inches of snow on them, but that snow was probably a blessing. For one thing, they now travel out of sight of owls, cats, and other nocturnal hunters. They can circulate from the bird seed to the stash of stolen corn, to a decaying jack-o'-lantern, all under cover. And they're probably warmer, too. With a shovel, I chop through 18 inches of layered ice and snow, lay a thermometer on the frozen grass, and refill the hole. When I retrieve it, a half hour later, it reads 25 degrees, 13 warmer than the air. At this time of day, my mice are deep under the snow, saving their fat. To make it last longer, they zipped up their coats back in autumn. The winter fur of a deer mouse is one-third warmer than the summer fur, and it's fluffable. The key to Owens Corning insulation is that the glass fibers trap air, and that slows the migration of heat. Mouse fur is like adjustable Owens Corning. On a day like this, my mice can fluff air into their fur. Then during the January thaw, should we be blessed with one, they can flatten their fur and squeeze out the air. The mice are also wearing long underwear. They probably began laying on brown fat when the days got shorter back in the fall. Like white fat, brown fat holds in body heat, but it can also generate warmth. In the summer, a chilly mouse might shiver, letting metabolism in her muscle cells raise her temperature, but that's akin to running your car's engine in a parking lot, just to keep the heater blasting. Brown fat produces heat all by itself, with no wear and tear on the muscles. Inevitably, heat will radiate out through my hidden mice, but that heat needn't rush into the cold air. Under the snow and in tree cavities, the mice have built nests lined with plant down and shredded leaves. Like a sleeping bag, a nest arrests the flight of body heat. My mice can stretch their blubber even further if they all pile into a single sleeping bag. Scrappy and territorial in summer, mice in winter turn cuddly. As many as a dozen strangers will share a nest. With most of each mouse's surface packed against another mouse, there's less surface exposed to the air. They all stay warm longer. Huddling does have a serious drawback. It increases the amount of competition for food in the area near the nest. But the benefits of cuddling must outweigh the penalties. Huddling mice are more likely to lose weight than loners, indicating that winning food is less important to them than keeping the peace with their bedfellows. Even with all these precautions, a mouse may still fail to scrounge up as many calories as she burns each day. In that case, she can lower her body temperature a few degrees, falling into shallow torpor. And it works. The mouse who spends this crystalline day cuddling with strangers in a nest, and who allows herself to go a bit sluggish, will burn less than half the calories required by a wakeful mouse who has neither sleeping bag nor friends. Squirrels walk a finer line through winter. Stumpy, Crook, and Friends time their mating marathon to coincide with the weeks when both temperature and food supplies are grinding along the bottom of their cycles. At my nearest apple tree, I examine a patch of snow on the twisted trunk. It's an amber color. Pea? I'm surprised to find the odor floral, but it must be pea. Circling the trunk, I discover that squirrel teeth have chopped chunks of bark from around a hole in the trunk. A male squirrel has left a message for the girls to read. They've all been acting funny lately. I've caught Crook getting squirrely with the shrubbery. A normal squirrel one minute, the next he'll ambush a nearby branch and whirl around it a dozen times. I can't tell if he's fighting with the shrub, or mating with it, or just blowing off squirrel steam. He might thrash for half a minute before popping off the branch and settling down. Without knowing the function of this behavior, it's hard to say he's wasting calories. He may be training for the great and gory mating race. That event will definitely be a caloric catastrophe, but it's not a waste. It could produce a new generation of little crooks. As the cold days pass, the pre-race formalities intensify. One day, Stumpy, my little amputee, is just another squirrel unearthing blackened acorns from the bare earth at the base of a tree. The next day, she's a hot ticket. Everywhere she goes, at least one male follows. Usually two or three lope in her wake, and this is not the main event. The boys are just monitoring Stumpy's hormonal status. They don't want to be sleeping in on the morning when she wakes up in a mating mood. So for a few days they forego calorie gathering and dedicate themselves to sniffing Stumpy's pheromones. They burn stored fat recklessly. Every trip up a tree trunk in pursuit of the girl torches another clump of calories. Every chase of a competing male is an expenditure, and Stumpy isn't the boy's only quarry. Every morning each male in the neighborhood is probably making a circuit to sniff half a dozen females. When Stumpy's big day dawns, she pokes her head out of the oak leaf dray she shares with her female kin. She's nose to nose with every boy in the neighborhood. They know. Some may already be bleeding from the ear or rump, having battled for a position near the nest. One may even try to crawl into the dray. She'll scold him out, and then she'll bolt. The boy follows. Scientists call this event a mating bout. For squirrels, mating is a contact sport. As Stumpy zigs and zags, whirls up and down tree trunks, a pack of males jostles and snarls behind her. The forerunners expose their haunches and tails to the followers. The followers slash those haunches and bite those tails. The competition between males may get so frenzied that the boys lose sight of the girl. In that case, they may rush after a bird or any other squirrel-sized distraction. Squirrel researchers Michael Steele and John Kaprowski once rolled a softball through a mating chase and saw six males peel off the pack to court the ball. A male may eventually maneuver Stumpy onto a high tree branch and grip her for mating. But even if he can repel the rammings and slashings of the other boys, he could still lose the insemination privilege. Stumpy may jerk from his grasp in what's called a breakaway. She'll get herself down from the tree and into a safer, quieter spot. Then she'll mate with the first male who finds her. This is the moment the younger men have been waiting for. Instead of wasting energy fighting with older males, some clever studs have been killing time on the ground, hoping for a breakaway. The male who mates with Stumpy takes a couple of steps to ensure the success of his sperm. To seal the deal, his ejaculate will harden into a copulatory plug, which blocks her vagina. Then he'll guard her for a while to give his little swimmers a jump on the competition. And there will be competition. Stumpy will groom herself, pull the plug, and resume the mating race. When the excitement dims with the afternoon sun, Stumpy will have collected sperm from 2 to 4 males. Some of them very fit, some of them very lucky. Some may have given the race everything they've got. In North American tree squirrels, Steele and Kaprowski report watching a fox squirrel crawl out of bed one morning and tumble dead to the ground. The rogue had mated with 5 females in the previous days, and an autopsy showed that he'd starved to death. Among my local boys, I notice only minor damage after the melee. All sport tooth-sized gaps in their tail fur, and a couple have torn ears. As for Stumpy, she faces the prospect of growing squirrelettes in the dead of winter, with her food entombed under 18 inches of snow and ice. But there is a method to this midwinter madness. The arrival of the kids will coincide with a springtime flush of food. And based on the number of squirrels in my yard, they're managing fine. Nonetheless, I feel sorry for the girl. I take to scattering a corn and sunflower mix on the snow every morning. Crook and Fluff, my big-tailed squirrel, eat most of it, but Stumpy comes around some afternoons for the leftovers. If I step out to toss her more, she wheels on her peg leg and dashes for the shrubs. Most of my mammals trudge straight through the winter along with the mice and squirrels. Shrews hunt chilled insects. Possums mine compost piles and gestate possumlets. Even Stunky, the skunk, releases the occasional cloud of chemistry from under the porch, although I can't find a skunk track to save my life. But one animal has dropped completely out of sight. Crunching past the shed, I check the woodchuck hole at the corner. I stand in the glassy wind and listen, knowing I'll hear nothing. If Big Fat Mama is directly beneath my snowshoes, I'll never know it. Even if I were inside her hibernaculum, there would be little to hear. Wherever she's curled up, she's inhaling only every few minutes. If I had a stethoscope pressed to her chest, I'd have to wait 15 seconds to hear a thud. Hibernation is a rare art. Everything I thought I knew about it is wrong. Black bears, for instance, the poster critters for hibernation, well, they don't technically hibernate. They inhale too often, they stay too warm, and they wake up too easily. They don't qualify. Animals who zonk out for a few days in a row, such as skunks, raccoons, and chipmunks, they aren't hibernating either. But the woodchuck, that's an animal who can hibernate. When Big Fat Mama entered her grass-lined hibernaculum last fall, she reduced the rate at which her cells burn fuel. The cool-burning cells needed less fuel delivered, so her heart rate drifted down to a few pumps per minute. Her cells called for less oxygen, so her respiratory rate dwindled to a breath every 3 or 4 minutes. By contrast, a chipmunk who sleeps off a few days of hard weather still breathes 20 times a minute. Big Fat Mama's slow metabolism produces less heat, so her body has cooled to just 8 degrees above freezing. To avoid icing up, she's burning a small amount of brown fat. If that were all she had to do, hibernation would be a snap, but there are problems. One is that brown fat requires water to burn. Under the snow, under the ground, Big Fat Mama's body is becoming dehydrated. This problem is eased by another problem. She's burning up muscle, too. That will leave her weak in the spring, but at least the process returns some water to her blood. The second difficulty is that she has to warm herself and arise from hibernation about every 2 weeks. This is hideously expensive in terms of stored fat. Hibernators blow at least half of their winter blubber in periodic heat-ups. Each time Big Mama wakes, she'll drag herself into a latrine chamber to defecate. But that may not be the reason she spends so much fat to wake up. It may be that she desperately needs sleep. Strange as it sounds, brain waves in western ground squirrels reveal that they start running a sleep deficit when they hibernate. The deficit builds. After a week or so, a hibernating squirrel pours a bucket of fat on the fire and raises his body temperature to the normal range. Then he sleeps a normal sleep. After about half a day, he throttles back and returns to deep hibernation. Rousing may serve a combination of purposes. A young psychologist from Ohio State University suspects hibernators wake up to give their immune systems a chance to hunt down germs. Brian Prendergast injected hibernating golden-mantled ground squirrels with bacterial fragments that should have incited their immune systems to spike a defensive fever. Nothing happened. At least, not until the squirrels naturally cycled into a warm-up a few days later. Then they spiked the fever. Prendergast theorizes that white blood cells can't function at low hibernation temperature. Through the winter, Prendergast found that these heat-ups consumed up to 80% of the squirrel's fat. So whatever they're waking up for, it's important. Big Mama breathes on under my snowshoes. It isn't the easy life it's reputed to be. Whereas the shrews, who hunt all winter, can gain weight in the cold, Big Fat Mama is wasting away. But none of the paths through winter is easy. The woodchuck hibernates because she eats only green things, which dried and died last fall. She's hoping that if she burns calories slowly enough, she can make her dinner last until breakfast is served. In contrast, those squirrels and mice who invested their energy storing food for the winter now risk having it stolen, which would be calamitous. Even the raccoons and skunks, whose dietary flexibility allows them to eat whatever they can dig out of a snowbank, risk being interrupted by a dog or a coyote as they hunt calories. Winter is just hard. On frigid days like this, small birds are rare in the yard. Perhaps they're perched outside the travel agency window, dreaming of Costa Rica. The crows, though, never miss a day. These mornings they come home from the rookery hungry. They land in the oak tree and wait for me to notice them. When I toss food, they flutter down with less than the usual dawdling and spooking themselves that so often results in seagulls or starlings getting the victuals. Between bites, they clutch up one foot, warming it among the breast feathers. Warming my own digits indoors, I consult Peter Marchand's Life in the Cold to see why the crow's feet haven't frozen off long since. Their legs contain heat exchangers, Marchand explains. When it's cold outside, cold blood returning to the body's core is channeled through a special set of veins that wrap around a hot artery. The cold blood warms up, and the arterial blood, heading out of the feet, passes off its precious heat to the veins before it circulates through the feet. The feet stay colder than the rest of the body, but they still get enough circulation to scramble over ice or to karate kick a dangerous piece of steak. Through the window, I watch the crows snatch up kibbles. When Yawp and Droopy feed too close to an adult these days, they risk being jabbed. They're learning to give their elders a wide berth. I wonder whether this jabbing is a lesson in etiquette, or if it's an indication that the crows are no more joyful about the 13 coldest days of the year than I am. Dave Santoro maintains that every batch of air brings its own mood. The mood associated with this string of 12-degree days is tense, with shivering. Besides the crows and winter birds like chickadees and cardinals, I'm surprised at who else stays. One day I look out to see two crows in the oak tree, working up the nerve to collect their kibbles from the snow. Two more are flying in from the neighbor's yard, when into their midst hurtles my old friend, the sharp-shinned hawk. Wings and legs akimbo, Sharpie dodges, or maybe aims for, various crows and tree branches. He crash lands on a limb and shakes himself. If he was hoping to catch a crow, my pals aren't going to give him the satisfaction of a single squawk. The two in the tree shift on their branches until their backs are to him. They gaze at the landscape. The two incoming crows land near Sharpie, then arrange themselves similarly. The last two family members arrive, and they, too, offer Sharpie a view of their tails. Perhaps feeling very small, Sharpie departs. A few days later, I find bits of a sparrow in the bamboo wilderness. The snow is bloody and feathered, but scarcely a bone remains. Sifting the snow with a twig, I find just the wings and the beak parts, upper separated from lower. The only track I can discern in the trampled snow is an arc, a few inches from the kill site. The tail waggle of a happy hawk? The predatory birds wouldn't stick around for the winter if there was nothing to eat. Starlings stay by the bushel. I know Sharpie enjoys them, and even the crows take an occasional run at them when they find a flock stealing their kibbles. I never see them connect, although I'd like nothing better. The crows are also welcome to eat the yappity English sparrows, and in that department they may have succeeded. One day I spot a brown lump 6 feet up in the forsythia bush. It's a dead sparrow who has been rammed upside down into a twist of branches and left for a hungry day. Around here only crows and jays would store meat, and it is a jay whom I notice storing butchered sparrow pieces the following day. He pokes a lump into the snow beside a bamboo stem. He chops at a wing, then carries it to the south neighbor's roof and tucks it between shingles. But whether he killed the sparrow or raided someone else's cache, I don't know. Who killed the seagull is equally mystifying. There's no blood this time, but about half a seagull's worth of feathers blow around on the snow. Not a track mars the scene. Whoever plucked the gull did it up in a tree. Both I and the crows have noticed a large hawk, perhaps a red-tailed, overhead this winter. The killer may also have been an owl. Some winters a snowy owl will drift down from Canada to hunt mice from a downtown building or a street light. Since they can nab backyard chickens, they may also be able to tackle a gull. Great horned owls also take chickens and crows, so why not a gull? But I haven't seen either owl this winter. Urban predators have more on their menu today than they did a few decades ago. Chickadees and juncos have always been bountiful fare in winter, but as winters warm, other tidbits become available. This winter, white-crowned sparrows are on special. When these stripy-headed cuties appeared in the yard in October, I presumed they'd continue south for the winter. But through cold November and bitter December, they stayed, scratching at the lawn. When the snow flew on Christmas, I thought for sure they'd scram. But they didn't. Shrugging off the English sparrow's bullying, they set up house in the forsythia hedge and collected the seeds I scattered each day. I consulted my Peterson guide for a map of the bird's winter range. The blue shading ended about 300 miles south in Long Island, New York, but my guide was published in 1980. On the Internet, I tapped up a newer map and found that the blue now washes all the way up the coast of Maine. whether the white-crowned sparrows are adapting to northern living or are taking advantage of climate change, they chose a rough year to push their limits. The atmospheric gears that pull the jet stream across the Atlantic are sluggish this year, according to Dave Santoro. As a result, the jet stream, which marks the boundary between Canadian frigid air and continental pretty cold air, has sagged deep into the southeast. The eastern United States is being blitzed with blizzards and harsh freezes. One windy night, the hard air penetrates the northwest wall of my house and freezes the water inside a valve of the dishwasher. When the appliance thaws in the morning, a flood sweeps across the kitchen floor. Wringing out towels, I contemplate anew the economics of migration. But the saggy jet stream doesn't impel the white-crowned sparrows to run for Long Island. Perhaps they can't afford to stop eating long enough to pack their bags. Getting through a winter day isn't easy for any bird, and the nights can be fatal, but of course they have their tactics. Come nightfall, the songbirds find a sheltered spot in an evergreen. There they probably shiver all night, producing heat in their moving muscles. They fluff air into their feathers. They minimize their surface area by tucking head against back. Some even drop their body temperature a few degrees and become slightly torpid. I suppose it's possible some species will huddle like mice, although this has been documented only once in a forest-dwelling kinglet. Even with all these precautions, though, most birds carry only enough fat to get them through one brutal night. Come daylight, they have no choice but to find more fuel. My reaction to this knowledge is predictably unobjective. Now that I know the peril my birds face, I feed them faithfully. The cardinals get sunflower seed. The sparrows and juncos get small seed. So my songbirds won't weary their little legs, I pack the snow for them. The crows get their kibbles and table scraps, and in a voice that seeks the middle ground between attracting birds and confirming the neighbor's worst suspicions, I whisper, yell, "Crow, crow, crow, crow," and they come. The crows love meat best. Nuts are also coveted. Dry cat food is acceptable, but perhaps a challenge to swallow. They spit out the X shapes over and over until they find a comfortable fit. Small kibble dog food is better. Crackers aren't always worth the bother. Bread is okay, but large pieces of any food attract seagulls. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.